Everybody kicks themselves over not having bought earlier. We can say that about any asset. My father used to tease me that he bought his first house for $19,000.
Everyone I know earned 9%, you know, doing their 60-40 thing, or 7%. And I earned 14%. Like, I, you know, almost doubled. And all I did was I allocated a bit to Bitcoin. And like, maybe that's the thing that gets them more interested in what is this technology.
I believe failure to own Bitcoin is a violation of your fiduciary duty. If you are being a complacent advisor, too lazy to bother, you are not acting as a fiduciary for your client.
You know, I think about the people who don't have assets to keep up with inflation, and every month, their grocery bill gets harder and harder.
We could get to a balanced budget. We could have a beginning of debt reduction if the economy grows enough. To me, the only real opportunity for that to happen is Bitcoin.
Hey there, Michael here with the Bitcoin Wave podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I am pleased to announce I have Mr. Rick Edelman, the man who probably needs no introduction, but if you're unfamiliar, he founded the largest IRA financial advisory in the United States. He is now working on the Digital Assets Council of Financial Professionals, and so he is educating folks on crypto, Bitcoin, why financial advisors need to be encouraging their clients to allocate to Bitcoin. We talk a lot about crypto versus Bitcoin. I obviously pushed a little bit on some of his discussion of crypto, but I think he's very much a Bitcoiner. He understands the benefit. He even talked about not selling. This was a great conversation. We covered a lot of ground in just about an hour. I think you're going to enjoy this one. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I have Rick here. Rick, thank you so much for taking time to join the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Michael, it's such a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
Looking forward to this conversation. So you made some big waves this summer. You released a white paper and you talked about the death of the 60-40 portfolio, which is heresy. I didn't know you were allowed to say that in the financial world. I would love to hear, before we get into Bitcoin and crypto specifically, could you talk about the macro, the market, the technological trends that you're seeing that have sort of shifted your mindset on the 60-40 portfolio?
Sure. My training is, as I'm sure everyone knows, as a financial advisor, I built the largest financial planning and investment management firm in the nation. It's now managing around $300 billion in assets for 1.4 million households. And throughout the last 40 years, my focus has always been on the future, trying to figure out what's coming next, right? You know, the Wayne Gretzky thing of going where the puck is not yet, but headed. And so I've been immersed in the context of futurism, predominantly with aging and longevity. This is all a result of medical innovation, which is all a result of exponential technologies. Nanotech, biotech, bioinformatics, 3D printing, of course, AI and robotics. And all of these new medical innovations are dramatically increasing our rate of life expectancy to the point that scientists in this field are now often saying that if you are alive in 2030, odds are really good you're going to live to age 100 or beyond. So it's not just babies born today that are going to live a long age. So will you and me. And that raises a really fundamental question in the field of personal finance. If I'm going to live to age 100, will my money last as long as I do? We know there's a retirement crisis in this country. We know that too few Americans are saving enough money. We know that they struggle to pay their bills monthly. We know that they're struggling to earn a good return on the money they have saved. So how do we reconcile the fact that millions of Americans are ending retirement with too little money, and that's at today's life expectancy rates of 78 or 80. What happens when everybody is living to 95 or 100 or beyond? This is why the 60-40 portfolio model is dead. The 60-40 has been built, it's been around for decades, ever since I've been an advisor in the 80s. 60% stock, 40% bonds. The attitude has always been, you go with a 60-40, and as you get older, you begin to reduce the equity allocation. You reduce your exposure to stocks from 60 down to 50, then 40, 30, 20, so that by the time you're in your 70s, you have very little money in stock, because in your 70s, you don't have long to live, you can't take big risk, make sure your money is safe. Well, that worked 50 years ago, but it doesn't work in an exponential world, a technological environment, certainly not one where we're going to live to 90 and 100 and 110. Meaning, if you follow that traditional 60-40 glide path, you are probably going to go broke long before you die. So I'm arguing two things. Number one, we need to have more of our money in equities. Instead of 60%, it's probably going to need to be 80%. And you need to do it for much longer than you ever did before. Well into your 80s and 90s, you need to be most of your money in equities. And number two, a big chunk of those equities needs to be crypto. You should have a minimum of 10% and as much as 40% of your portfolio in Bitcoin and other digital assets. This has kind of blew up a lot of people's heads in the financial planning field, as you can imagine, Michael. The TradFi marketplace, that's my dog barking, if you can hear.
No worries.
That's kind of the exact opposite of what people normally expect a financial advisor like me to say. But we need to recognize that what got us here isn't going to get us there. That if we continue to manage our money in the next 30 years, the way we've managed it in the past 30 years, we will fail rather than succeed.
So how does, that makes a lot of sense. How does this, how are retirement ages impacted by this? Is there like an underlying assumption that people are going to want to continue retiring at a, you know, in that 60 to 70 age window? Or are you thinking people are going to have to also work longer? I mean, if you're living to 110, that's very different than even a conservative estimate of, you know, living to 90 or 100, right? So how does that factor in as people might think about this?
You're absolutely right, Michael. As I wrote in my book, The Truth About Your Future, which we published in 2017, I said at that point that retirement is dead. Retirement was a 20th century innovation. It didn't exist in the 1800s. If you were alive, you worked. You were either growing your food or shooting it in order to live. You had to work to maintain your ability to survive. In the 20th century, in the 1900s, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, people moved from the farm to the factory, and the notion of getting a pension came up, allowing you the opportunity to retire and still receive a monthly income. That worked fine when you retired at 65 and were dead by 80, but it isn't going to work if you retire at 65 and live to 95 or 100, because there's no way that the pension system in our country or the Social Security system was designed to make payouts for 30 or 40 years. So you're absolutely right. The notion of retiring at 65 is over. People are going to have to continue working. They're going to have to continue to produce an income. And partly, people are going to want to. I mean, if you're retiring for 30 or 40 years, you're bored out of your mind. You're going to want to stay engaged and involved just because it's fun to do. Otherwise, you're going to sit home and watch TV all day. So people, for both of those reasons, will engage. And it increases the importance of investing effectively and correctly in the investments of the future, not the investments of the past. And the best investment opportunity, bar none, is Bitcoin.
I love to hear that. So I want to add sort of my opinion. I'd love to hear your thoughts on something, because I agree with you. I think people are going to live longer. My hope is that we turn the corner on healthier lifestyles to where people are living not just longer because science and medical innovations are keeping them alive, but they're actually living better and are able to work till they're 80 because they have the capacity to do so. What I look at as a Bitcoiner, like what really turned me on to Bitcoin was becoming, I guess, enlightened to how fractional reserve banking works and how the Federal Reserve functions. And I look at, you know, we just hit $38 trillion in U.S. national debt and the unsustainability of that in the fiscal path that we're on. And in short, I guess, the need, I think, for a better solution than money that can be readily printed, manipulated, interest rates that can be adjusted by the whim of a handful of people meeting in a room. And so I view it, While I completely hear you on the medical innovation, I view it as a necessity because of the the fragile nature of the economic system. I would be curious to hear, is that something you agree with, or is that something you sort of incorporate into how you think about this?
No question. You know, there is no question that there are some very significant, very serious headwinds that we're facing on a global basis. I'm not going to talk about the geopolitical issue. That's a whole huge conversation by itself. Let's just talk about the economic issue. The debt, not just here in the United States, but on a global scale. Our governments around the world have managed to put themselves into unprecedented levels of debt, and they are, on an annual basis, making it worse. Here in the United States in particular, we're seeing a blurring of the lines between the two political parties. It used to be that the Democrats loved to spend and the Republicans loved to cut. And now we have Republicans spending as randomly as the Democrats are, which means the federal debt is growing at an ever larger rate. It raises the very simple fundamental question, how much longer can this persist? And what happens to the economic structure and the viability of our economy and the safety of our wealth when that does finally break? And this is why assets that are detached from the current economic system, that are de-linked from our financial system, make an awful lot of sense. And Bitcoin, of course, is the poster child for that.
So if you were to pull out a crystal ball and speculate on how long, like, when does the music stop? And then what does that look like in the aftermath of the music stopping, on sort of the madness of what we've seen the last, you know, since at least 1971, in my view? Do you think we have a long runway here? Is it 5 years? Is it 20 years? Is it 100 years? Like, if you were to sort of step back and think about, like, when does this change come?
It's really hard to say, Michael. And my suspicion is that it isn't going to be a cliff. It's going to be instead more gradual. I don't think we're going to wake up one day and discover that our banking system has collapsed and the Fed is dissolved. I think instead we're going to discover that it's a boiling frog instead. You know, we all know the boiling frog syndrome of slowly turning up the heat and letting him boil to death, because if you throw him in a pot of boiling water, he'll jump right out. So I think instead we're going to continue to see the erosion of the value of the dollar. It's lost 50% of its assets just this century. It's down over 90% over the past 100 years. I think that trend is going to persist. I think it is likely that we will continue to see inflation eroding the fundamental economic foundation and safety net that most investors and savers are using, because they are saving in inflation-sensitive instruments. Bank CDs, money market accounts, checking, savings, T-bills, and so on. And that's where the big problem is going to arise. I'll give you a great example. We routinely find in our firm's practice, when people retire at age 65, they're fine. They're in great economic condition. They have easily enough money to support themselves and their lifestyles in retirement. That's at age 65. When we look at clients who are 85, 20 years into their retirement, we discover that their retirement incomes have not kept up with the cost of living, because the cost of living pretty much doubles about every 25 years. So the car payment, the property tax, food, health insurance, all of these things double in price over the period of 20, 25 years, but the incomes don't of these retirees. So while they were fine as a new retiree, they're really struggling as an elder. And that's for people with assets. Imagine what it's like for people living only on Social Security, which is over half the retired population. So I think that this boiling frog scenario is going to make it much more precarious. Because quite frankly, if it was a sudden massive event, people would be able to adjust and adapt really, really quickly. We know when there's news of a hurricane, everybody very quickly battens down the hatches, grabs the sandbags, and evacuates. But when you suddenly just have it raining really hard for a really long time, that's when people's basements get flooded. And so I think I'm a little more concerned because of that. But I'll give you one area where I think we might have a way out. Okay. It's possible, Michael. And I don't mean this as a pipe dream. It's really possible that we might grow our way out of this crisis, meaning that if the economy grows significantly enough, if we amass a significant increase in wealth, that increases the tax base. And that gives the government the money it needs to pay its bills and pay down the debt. We could get to a balanced budget. We could have a beginning of debt reduction if the economy grows enough. To me, the only real opportunity for that to happen is Bitcoin.
So, because to me, I hear you. To me, it does feel like a pipe dream. That said, we do have AI. We have the promise of, or at least the potential for new energy tech. I think energy is going to be an incredibly big deal, like beyond what most people think. The one of the challenges, like working in Bitcoin and, you know, trying to educate in this space, is it feels like so many people are asleep at the wheel. And I think it's so valuable that you've come out, while most financial advisors are completely asleep at the wheel, that you've come out and made, at least begun to change the conversation within like the traditional finance space, that this needs to be something that's on people's radar. But it still is, it's such an uphill battle. And I think most people don't understand fractional reserve banking, how money is printed, what, like they've heard this, you know, trillions of dollars of debt for so long and nothing has blown up, so to speak. And so there's no recognition that, you know, maybe it's boiling frog, but like maybe at some point we do just run it, like the government just has to print and we see inflation well beyond 9% or anything that we've seen before, because the only option, if they want to not default on the debt, is going to be to print money. And that's, I think, a base case that a lot of people, at least in our space and in Bitcoin, have. So I don't know. I don't know if you have any further comment on that, I hope you're right. I hope you're right.
There are a lot of nuggets in what you've said. For example, not just Bitcoin, but so many other industrial areas of exponential technologies, AI, robotics, the energy sector, as you cited. We are going to see massive innovations in all of these areas. We're going to move from people driving cars to robots flying our cars on our behalf. And this is coming within the next decade. Quantum computing is going to be something that is very tangibly of value to us in business and consumers within the next decade. The changes are coming at an unprecedented rate, and all of these things have a really tremendous opportunity as an investor. The reason I didn't cite them compared to Bitcoin is that it's really hard right now for you to make an investment in a VTOL, in a vertical takeoff and landing vehicle. It's really hard for you to invest in an AI company. It's really hard for you to invest in solar energy companies. And that's a challenge because of the way business operates today. But it is easy, very easy, for you to buy a Bitcoin or a fraction of one, a Satoshi. And this is my point, is that Bitcoin is unique, not merely because of the outperformance we're expecting it to produce over the next decade, but because it is so accessible to ordinary retail investors and consumers. And so I'm hopeful that all of these trends are going to come together and coalesce with government support and corporate engagement that is going to allow us to get to the next level. Because otherwise, I think we might have a pretty significant challenge ahead of us.
Yeah. Well, I love and appreciate your optimism, because we spend a lot of time focused in on all of the bad things that are happening when it comes to debt. And, you know, I think about the people who don't have assets to keep up with inflation. And every month, their grocery bill gets harder and harder. And I think that's maybe my biggest concern, is that, you know, the 50% or so of people who are already struggling to make ends meet, who don't own assets to keep up with inflation, are at some point going to wake up and realize, I'm not alone in this. Like, this isn't just my battle. This is all of my neighbors are struggling. We have whole pockets of cities that are struggling, and that there's going to be, and I hope this doesn't happen, but, you know, civil unrest, or, you know, I don't know, something to that effect, that maybe is a catalyst for change. But I don't want to, at the risk of sidetracking us, I'm curious, you've been doing this a long time. What was the last, I could guess it's probably like the dot-com, you know, era, but what was the last time where you had like a fundamental shift in your philosophy the way that you have with, you know, crypto?
That's a good question. We probably made our last innovative shift which was coincident with Bitcoin, with the broader array of exponential technologies. And this was in 2012. That was when I was, in fact, introduced to Bitcoin. I've been involved in Bitcoin since then. And that is when we really began a deep study and analysis of exponential technologies, because it was at that stage that computer technology was really reaching the knee of the curve. We know how exponentiality works, how money doubles, and that it looks like it's flatlining for a long time, but then it suddenly takes off like a hockey stick. And that knee of the curve, where it starts to really angle up, began to occur around 2010. And it took the internet that long. It took computer technology that long. Think of Moore's Law, where the price of computers drops by half and the power of computers doubles about every 18 to 24 months. And it allowed computer technology to get to the point around 2010 where we were beginning to see massive tangible improvements in capabilities, to the point where we saw some really exciting things coming. And so I began telling people in 2013, 2014 to buy Bitcoin. I created the Digital Assets Council of Financial Professionals in 2015. I launched my book, The Truth About Your Future, a deep dive into Expo Tech in 2017. And I created the XT, the Exponential Technologies ETF with BlackRock and Morningstar in 2017 as the very first Exponential Technologies ETF for ordinary retail investors, because I recognized this was an investment opportunity that had never existed before and was going to be unprecedented in its ability to deliver above average returns at below average risk, exactly what that fund did for the next 5+ years. So we now see a similar pivot point with crypto. Bitcoin was largely ignored for the first 5 years. It was lambasted and criticized for much of its history, but we have had a sea change, as we all know, the knee of the curve with the election of Donald Trump in almost 1 year ago. That clock is never going to get turned off. We are never going to go backward. We are only just now at the very early innings of this. And so it all began, I would say, in 2012 with my exploration of exponential technologies from an investment management perspective.
Okay. Well, kudos to you. I didn't realize the Digital Assets Council was in 2015. You're a decade old. So you really were early on in this. So you mentioned the crypto allocation recommendations. So, this was kind of the headline news. 10% in a conservative portfolio, 40% in a more aggressive portfolio, somewhere in between for anyone else. And I'm curious, I guess there could be a few questions in here. So one would be, how did you sort of land on that range? And then I suppose majority of what you're displacing is stock equity allocation into a variety of potential crypto investments. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Could you maybe describe how you landed on those numbers and how you see that functionally? What does the portfolio now look like? Is it 40% stock, 40% some sort of crypto, and then, 20%? Bonds or is it something else?
Yeah, that's exactly right. For an aggressive investor, 40-40-20 is the ratio. 40% in a broad-based stock allocation, 40% in a broad-based crypto allocation. We can talk about how, what does that really mean? And 20% in fixed income, largely cash and more liquid assets for liquidity needs, income needs, et cetera. That's for an aggressive portfolio. And why 50-50? In the equity piece? Why half of it stock, half of it crypto? Or on the conservative portfolio, instead of 40-40-20, that would be 20% still in fixed income, 10% in crypto, and then the other 70% would be in equities. So why is that? It's because of two things. Number one, we recognize that Bitcoin remains a very volatile asset. And here, I'm not worried about volatility from a fundamental investment perspective. Volatility doesn't scare me, but I'm an investment professional with decades of experience. Most investors are not. Most investors have not been doing this for very long. They're not very good at it. They don't pay a lot of attention to it. They have very little training in it. And most people, let's face it, act emotionally rather than rationally. We don't think analytically. We react just you know, the way our evolution caused us to react. When you've got a choice, if you're walking in the savanna of Africa, as I was about a month ago, it was a fabulous trip, and you're in the bush and you see the grass is moving, you have a choice. You can decide it's a breeze or you can decide it's a lion. Well, if you decide it's a breeze and you're wrong, you're dead. And this is why humans have evolved to say, if I see that grass moving, I'm running. It's the fight or flight. And so people have that attitude with their investments today. If I see a decline in the price, I'm going to sell and run as an emotional reaction to defend myself. Well, that's understandable when you're confronted with a lion in Africa. I'm not sure it makes sense as an investor on Wall Street, because we know that the volatility isn't going to kill you. In fact, if you know how to use it to your advantage, it can be a very profitable strategy for wealth building. So I'm not worried about Bitcoin's volatility because of its volatility. I'm worried that the volatility may scare you out of it. Remember, I'm not dealing with people like you, Michael. I'm not dealing with Bitcoin maximalists. I'm not dealing with people who really understand what they're doing and why they're doing it and how they're doing it. I'm talking about people that are just trying to save for retirement, and they don't really understand the world of investing terribly well, and they don't understand the best way to do things and how to make it work for them long term. And I'm worried that if they have too heavy a Bitcoin allocation and then they experience volatility, it could scare them out of it at the very wrong time. And instead of making money, they'd end up losing money, defeating the whole purpose. So if you have a 80-20 portfolio where 80% is risk assets, 20% are T-bills, in that 80, if 10 of the 80 is Bitcoin, I think you'll be able to tolerate the volatility because it's only $1 out of $8. And I think you can handle it and you'll live with it and you won't allow the emotionalism caused by volatility to interrupt your efforts. If you have a higher risk tolerance, which is usually a result of people having more experience, they can tolerate volatility more, which means they can take that 10% and move it up all the way up to 40% or half of their equity exposure.
Are you still, RIAs, are they continually rebalanced? So let's say you got a client into this sort of a 40-40-20 portfolio. Are they proactively reallocating and right-sizing the portfolio to maintain that 40-40? Like, are they, you know, hey, Bitcoin, you know, if Bitcoin ripped to, you know, 250,000 over the next 6 months, are they going to sell and diversify back into, you know, get back to 40-40? Are you saying, hey, let's keep the winners, and so it kind of shifts as you go? Or like, how conservative are you on like the more aggressive portfolios, I guess, is maybe a way of framing it?
So let's be clear. Let me draw a bright line. I am not involved in the day-to-day management activities of the firm I founded. They are not doing aggressive crypto allocations, the last I heard, nor are most financial advisors. And I don't really know of any who are recommending a 40% allocation to any of their clients. There probably are some out there somewhere. I haven't met them. Most financial advisors who are engaging in crypto are doing low single digits, 2-5% of their overall portfolios, which is translating, if it's a 60-40 portfolio, that's translating for of the 60. If they're doing a 5% allocation, you know, that's 5 out of 60, which is a pretty big portion of the equities, more in line of my 10% allocation for investors. I will say this, all advisors, including those at the firm I created, are very actively engaged in rebalancing. Rebalancing is a very important element of proper portfolio management because it helps to smooth out volatility and turn it to your advantage. When you engage in rebalancing, you're selling assets when they outperform, which means you're selling high, you're capturing the profit. And when those assets fall in value due to volatility, you're buying them while they're down, enabling you to lower your average cost, helping to improve your future profits. So rebalancing is a brilliant idea. Every financial advisor I know who's any good does it and does it routinely, but it raises an interesting question. Should you, in fact, rebalance a portfolio that includes Bitcoin? And here, I got to be honest with you, Michael, I've never rebalanced out of my crypto because rebalancing has one disadvantage. It does have you sell periodically because it rises faster than other assets. And that means you're going to sell some of your Bitcoin because it's outperformed. My personal view is that I believe Bitcoin is going to continue to outperform other assets so dramatically, I'm unwilling to rebalance out of it, which has contributed to my being overweighted in Bitcoin because of my bullishness about it. Am I recommending that? No, I really can't because it flies in the face of everything I believe about proper portfolio management. But for me and my circumstances, I'm willing to tolerate the deviation.
Yeah, that, I think that makes a lot of sense. I shudder at the thought of selling my Bitcoin, so I can certainly relate. Okay, so here's where I may play a little bit of devil's advocate and prod a little bit. Crypto. So that's like it's a term I've used on this particular podcast now a few times, but not generally. I talk about Bitcoin. I'm curious if you could distinguish between, because you've distinguished Bitcoin a few times here, in how you think about Bitcoin versus crypto. And then we'll get into also, I think you've talked about other ways of making that 10 to 40% allocation, you know, into Bitcoin miners, ETFs, other sort of adjacent, investment options. How do you distinguish Bitcoin from crypto?
So this is a little bit of a long conversation. It's a great question and worthy of an answer. And I'll warn your audience, because I know, having listened to your podcast often, I know your audience, and they are predominantly Bitcoin maximalists. That's not who I talk to on a regular basis. Keep in mind, I'm a financial advisor and I'm deep in TradFi. Most of my time is spent with the financial advisory community, the RIAs, the asset management firms, the ETF providers, and such, working with them, training them, helping them build their businesses, helping them understand crypto, and so on. I don't talk to Bitcoin people because they already know what I have to say. So here's my message. Here's what you need to understand. What I say, why I say it, and who I'm saying it to. First, there's Bitcoin, and then there's everything else in crypto. So Bitcoin kind of stands alone as the store of value. It's not only the oldest and largest and best known, it really has no competition. There's nothing out there in the world of crypto that does what Bitcoin does as well as Bitcoin does it. And I don't really see anybody on the horizon coming along that might displace that, certainly not in the foreseeable future. So it's easy to say, why don't I just buy Bitcoin, check the box, call it a day, move on? I won't disagree with that. You can certainly make an argument for that. However, in the financial advisory world, that thought is a little unsettling, because financial advisors are trained to diversify. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't buy a single stock, buy every stock. Don't just own stocks, but add bonds and commodities and gold and oil and foreign assets, and on and on and on. The more you diversify, the lower setting the risk of the portfolio, and advisors care as much about risk as they do return, again, because they're dealing with a clientele that are often very nervous people. They don't want to lose their hard, life's work and life savings. So we believe in diversification, and Bitcoin is a single asset. So this is why I say to advisors, to make you more comfortable and to make your clients more comfortable, there's Bitcoin, but there's also more than Bitcoin. We can now go to the other side of the ledger. You got Bitcoin all by itself, and then you have everything else. Well, the everything else includes the different coins and tokens like Ethereum and Solana and Polygon and Algorand and Chainlink and on and on and on. You've got those other coins that you can diversify into. You also have crypto equities, publicly traded companies that are in the space like Circle and Coinbase and Galaxy and other publicly traded stocks that are in the crypto ecosystem. You also have Bitcoin treasury companies like Michael Saylor's Strategy. There are now dozens of those companies that are replicating or trying to replicate what Michael has done so well. You also have a variety of other subsectors of the marketplace, Bitcoin mining companies, for example, that you can engage in the space tangentially, that give you a way to engage in crypto with an effort to create a little bit more diversification than simply buying Bitcoin or a Bitcoin ETF might provide for you. That message resonates with the advisory community who is unfamiliar with crypto and a little nervous and skeptical about it, and their clients who are even less knowledgeable and even more skeptical. And it's all my way of saying to them, it's safe to get in the water. And while we could argue perhaps that Bitcoin might be the best single answer, you're not willing to do it. And you're certainly not willing to put 10 or 40% of your money into it. So it's my effort of getting you off of zero to allow you to realize it's safe to get in the water, get started, begin your journey down that rabbit hole. And the more time you do that, the more experience you'll develop, the more comfort you'll have, and then you'll be able to figure out what you really want to do long term. So part of the reason I'm arguing for crypto, which is not as definitive as the word Bitcoin, is because I'm not trying to pick a fight. When I'm simply trying to get the advisory community and the investor community off of zero.
Yeah, I think that's an important start. And I can empathize with the position you're in, because they're early on in my Bitcoin journey, I was very appreciative of many of the things Michael Saylor would say. And I've grown a bit disillusioned with some of the ways that he frames Bitcoin, because I view Bitcoin as a savings vehicle. It's the best form of money. I think it's the future of money. At the same time, I can sympathize that he has regulators, a publicly traded company that he operates. And so the things that he might want to say, or that I would want to say in that position, might just not be appropriate. It might not even be legal. I don't know what the ramifications would be. So I can appreciate that. So, okay, if this question isn't too involved, I would love to hear how you might. So let's dig a little bit further on that. You talked about treasury companies, ETFs, these other projects, obviously Bitcoin. We're big proponents of Bitcoin and proper 100% self-custody. How might you think about, if you're trying to educate a financial advisor who is thinking about diversification but does not have time to go study Bitcoin in 20 other projects and figure out which of the mining companies are the best, and you know, where do treasury companies fit in? Like, where would you get them started in thinking about what that 40% makeup might be?
It's going to be, in most cases, it's going to be exclusively ETFs. Exchange-traded funds are the most popular investment vehicle in the country, and certainly the most popular among financial advisors, and for all the right reasons. I was one of the early pioneers in the ETF marketplace in my practice. ETFs are incredibly inexpensive. They are highly liquid, fully transparent, incredibly convenient and easy to own, very tax efficient. People can do this by opening a simple Schwab account. They can do it at Fidelity. They can do it at Robinhood. They can do this in a whole bunch of different places. And in that brokerage account where they're buying all their investments, they can now buy a Bitcoin ETF and an Ethereum ETF. And there are now dozens of these crypto ETFs available that go beyond just Bitcoin or just Ethereum. You have crypto equity ETFs. We have buffer ETFs that say to the investor, we are going to insulate you against some of the volatility that Bitcoin has. There are leverage ETFs, which will say to some investors, we'll let you earn 2x the returns of Bitcoin instead of just one if you're really aggressive. We have income earning ETFs where we're doing options trading to generate income. One of the criticisms of Bitcoin, there's no income. Well, now there is through options trading, and in the case of Ethereum, staking. So you can generate income off of crypto. So my attitude is I'm not really terribly concerned about which of the ways you do it. I simply acknowledge that in the investment advisory world, they don't want to reinvent their technology stack. They don't want to have to retrain their staff, and they don't want to have to reculturalize their clients merely to allocate to crypto. So they want to do it as easily, painlessly, simplistically as possible. And for them, that usually translates to the ETFs. And it gets the job done. Now, is it ideal compared to your approach of buying it directly and storing it in a cold wallet? No, I won't argue with you, but I'll simply say we're not going to get most of America to do what you're doing.
Yeah, I think baby steps. It's that step in the right direction, and hopefully it sparks. You know, I don't know if you probably have seen this. I remember listening to a podcast or two a couple of years ago, and I heard something to the effect of, if you invested 2% of your portfolio in Bitcoin and kept 98% in cash for 4 years, any 4 years over the life of Bitcoin, you would have outperformed the S&P 500 or at least met the same returns. Now, I think when people, a lot of people would hear that, it would kind of go over their head, I suspect. But when you're watching it happen in your portfolio, you begin to realize what's going on. And my hope is that what you're describing here, even if you take a what I would consider a suboptimal approach to allocating to Bitcoin, it's just like it lights that fire of interest in my friend, everyone I know earned 9%, you know, doing their 60/40 thing, or 7%, and I earned 14%. Like, I, you know, almost doubled. And all I did was I allocated a bit to Bitcoin. And like, maybe that's the thing that gets them more interested in what is this technology. And they might find it less intimidating than they would have suspected.
Yeah, I'll give you two thoughts on that. One good, one bad. The good is, you're probably right. I've never looked at the data, but just in kind of off the top of my head, you're probably right. Any given 4-year period, it probably has outperformed. That's the good news. But here's the bad news. And a lot of folks in the crypto community don't understand this. Investment advisors and consumers have been trained to ignore comments like that, because the comment is a reflection of the asset's past performance. And it's been drilled into our heads. It's stamped on page one of every prospectus we've ever gotten, bold lettering, all caps, center of the page. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Any assertion to the contrary is a federal offense. So we take those kinds of statements of, gee, look how much money it's made, with a grain of salt, because it doesn't mean it'll continue to make that much money. So here's what I do to try to cut through that dilemma. The charts that I use in my training programs for advisors says, if you take just a 2% allocation, let's look at the range of potential outcomes. I'm not going to predict what's going to happen. I'll let you predict. And I say to the audience, you tell me. In fact, Michael, I'll ask you, is it possible for Bitcoin to go to zero, become worthless? Is it possible?
I suppose on a technical basis, it is possible.
I mean, we got to admit, as silly as the question is, yeah, it's possible. Now, on the other extreme, how high might it go? Do you think Bitcoin might rise to $1 million? Is that possible?
Absolutely.
So let's take those two extremes, okay? I'm not even sure $1 million is an extreme, but anyway, let's take those two extremes. Now let's plot it out over the next 5 years. And what we see is that Bitcoin is either going to go to zero, which means your portfolio, which had 100, is now going to have 2% be worthless, but the other 98% is going to grow at the rate of the stock market, which is a 10% average. You're going to end up with around a 7% return. On the other hand, if Bitcoin does absolutely great, you're not going to have 7%. You're going to have more like 70%. So the question I put to advisors is this: I'm going to give you three choices. You can either have Bitcoin or not. And one of three things is going to happen. The Bitcoin will be worthless. The Bitcoin will do what the stock market does. Or Bitcoin will do something sensational. And when you look at those three differences, you discover that not having any Bitcoin is silly. Because even if it goes worthless, it doesn't really hurt the client. It really doesn't damage their ability to retire in financial comfort in the future. So there's not a lot of downside to owning it, but you have massive potential upside. So it's not that I'm predicting it's going to do well. I'm not even bragging that it used to do well. I'm simply saying it makes sense on a risk-reward basis. And it's kind of hard to argue with that logic.
Yeah. I think the hurdle, though, I agree. The hurdle for a lot of people when they hear that, I think, is, but I'm late. Like, how could it possibly go higher than $125,000 a coin, right?
You know, it's funny you raise that. I wrote a white paper this past January, which is available at dacfp.com, dacfp.com, called The 6 Myths That Are Preventing You From Buying Bitcoin.
I've got that here.
That one that you just cited, it's too high, I missed it, is the first myth that people raise. Everybody kicks themselves over not having bought earlier. We can say that about any asset. My father used to tease me that he bought his first house for $19,000. We can say that about the stock market, because it's at today an all-time high, about gold an all-time high, about real estate an all-time high, Bitcoin an all-time high. That's the nature of time value of money. Everything in 20 years is higher in price than it was 20 years earlier. That's not a reason to avoid Bitcoin. Instead, what we need to ask ourselves is, what might the future price look like? And here, Bitcoin has a benefit that no other asset has: the fixed supply. We know that the number of shares of a stock can change at any moment. We know that the availability of real estate, the gold they pull out of the ground, the oil that they produce, those numbers change all the time. But Bitcoin's 21 million is fixed, which means with a fixed supply, all we have to look at is demand, because rising demand causes a rising price, falling demand, falling price. Right now, only 5% of the world's population owns Bitcoin. The other 95% haven't yet engaged. The vast majority of institutional investors, insurance companies, banks, brokerage firms, are not yet investing. Most family offices, not yet. Sovereign wealth funds, not yet. Because the rules and the regs have only just now begun to emerge, thanks to President Trump, and they're all busy getting ready, but they haven't yet fully engaged. Which means as they do and their assets flow, that 5% is going to grow dramatically to 15 or 20 or 25%. And that will take the price of Bitcoin up 400-500% or more. My prediction is that by the end of the decade, Bitcoin will be over 500,000. That's a 5x increase from today. Nobody anywhere is suggesting that that'll happen to the S&P 500 or to gold or to oil.
Yeah. I think maybe my frustration with traditional financial advisors on this subject is they seem, the handful that I know, is there just seems to be this sense of complacency.
Oh yeah.
Like there's the 60-40 portfolio will never die. Okay, maybe it's weighted slightly differently, but in principle it remains intact. And I think if we could just get like a copy of the Bitcoin Standard, you know, I think one of the great Bitcoin books in all of their hands, and they just read it with even a half open mind, I think what you described, those three scenarios, it goes to zero, it just kind of, you know, tracks the stock market or does very little, or it performs well.
You're absolutely right.
It becomes much easier for someone to imagine that option one is very unlikely, and option two is going to be less and less likely, and option three is probably should be your base case. But until you take the time to understand that Bitcoin isn't tulip bulb mania, like there are fundamentals to this that you can understand as you look at the macro picture, some of the, you know, the trends you've described, It makes so much sense why we're bullish long term.
You're absolutely right about complacency. I deal with this with advisors all the time, and it's really easy to understand why advisors are complacent when it comes to the subject of crypto. The average advisor in this country is 62 years old. They've been in this business for 20, 30, 40 years. They have a large book of clients who they serve, and they're managing a large amount of money. Typically hundreds of millions of dollars in assets. They're paid very well. Their clients are very happy. The returns have been very good. Why mess with that? I mean, it's really that simple. Their attitude is, why mess with that? I got to go learn about something brand new that I've never heard of before. And then I've got to teach it to my clients who never heard of it before either, and go to all this trouble in order to just give them a low single digit allocation. I think I'd rather go play golf instead. Yeah. And that complacency is a big reason why a lot of advisors are sitting on the sidelines. There are two other reasons we cannot ignore. Number one, the early history of Bitcoin does not favor paying attention. Mt. Gox, Silk Road, even more as recently as FTX, now 4 years old, give advisors a lot of pause of saying, all I keep hearing about are frauds and asset losses. Second, the regulatory environment that advisors live in has prohibited them from engaging in Bitcoin until the Bitcoin ETFs emerged almost 2 years ago. So advisors sat on the sidelines partly because they're complacent, partly because they were scared of the frauds they were hearing about, and partly because their compliance officers wouldn't let them do it anyway. So we need to help them understand that those three objections are gone, that they're doing their clients a huge disservice by remaining on the sidelines, that they're denying themselves the profit potential that this asset class offers, and more importantly, they're going to lose credibility in the marketplace by continuing to stay on the sidelines, because our survey research is showing that the majority of clients now expect their advisor to give them advice on Bitcoin. And an advisor who doesn't know anything about it can't do that. So we are getting more and more advisors turning to us for our education. We offer the CBDA professional designation, certified in blockchain and digital assets, that teaches advisors all this so that they can engage with their clients, shows them how to do it and how to communicate with clients in a way the clients want to hear it. And it's a very effective program used by advisors and brokerage firms around the country. I'm doing a 2-hour keynote presentation at Charles Schwab's annual advisor conference in 2 weeks in Denver, because advisors are behind the curve. And as you said it right, it's because largely of their complacency. And they will die on the vine if they maintain that attitude.
Yeah. So I hear you. That's my biggest sense. At the same time, I can also empathize with the lack of regulatory clarity, and you have to be more cautious. You can have, licensure revoked and, that sort of thing. If you were still working and operating day to day with Edelman Financial Engines, would you have to be more cautious in how you've approached this with this topic on podcasts, in the white papers you've written, starting this other organization to educate? Like, if you were still operating primarily as someone who was a voice to financial advisors the way that historically you have been, would you need to be careful in how you approach this? Or could you say what you're saying?
No, I would not have to be any more careful. I mean, I've been doing this for 40 years, running Edelman Financial. I was a principal, a licensed principal with FINRA, and of course, licensed the SEC. I was a FINRA arbitrator. I used to be one of the judges people would go to hearings for when they felt they got ripped off by their advisor. Compliance is so ingrained with me that everything I still say and do, I am convinced is fully compliant. That's not the issue. A lot of people are very fearful about compliance, but unnecessarily so. The SEC and FINRA are not objecting to crypto. They have the same concern about crypto they do about any other asset, whether it's a stock or a bond or real estate or a mutual fund or an ETF. They want to know that you have full disclosure, that you are transparent, that you are avoiding conflicts of interest, and that you're disclosing conflicts that you cannot avoid. And as long as you're doing those things, you're free to do whatever you need to do. You just need to be able to show the regulators that you are acting properly, prudently, and in the client's best interest as a fiduciary. Investing in crypto is not a violation of your fiduciary duty. In fact, I would turn that upside down. I believe failure to own Bitcoin is a violation of your fiduciary duty. If you are being a complacent advisor, too lazy to bother, you are not acting as a fiduciary for your client. And I could argue that a 10% allocation is much more fulfilling as a fiduciary than a zero allocation. So I would not have any concern what I'm saying, how I'm saying it, whether I'm licensed or not.
I completely agree with you. And that makes sense, because I know of at least a small handful of very small financial advisory firms who are like, they're Bitcoiners like myself, but their background is in TradFi, and they're advising their clients on right-sizing their portfolio. And many of their clients will come to them and say, hey, I need help with, estate planning, some of these other sort of ancillary things. And they want a 50, 80, 100% allocation to Bitcoin. And I was trying to understand why they aren't getting in trouble. And so your point is, it's not that you can't do that. It's that you need to understand why you're doing it. If you were to be investigated, you need to have a good explanation. I think the returns, the dollar denominated returns of Bitcoin alone, I think stand.
No, that's not, the SEC is not going to buy that. You can't
what
give
they,
me.
What do they care about?
Like I said, past performance doesn't guarantee the future. So you can't say I gave the client a 100% Bitcoin portfolio because over the last 10 years it did so well. That won't work. What you have to show is that it is in the client's best interest relative to their circumstances, their goals, their risk tolerance, and their overall objectives. I don't know that you'd be able to justify 100% Bitcoin allocation to anybody, quite frankly. I teased Mike Novogratz, the principal of Galaxy, who's everybody, you know, he's well known as a billionaire. And I made the joke with Michael. I said, Michael, you can put 80% of your money into Bitcoin. I said, you can put all of your money into Bitcoin. You're so wealthy. If Bitcoin falls 80%, you're still a billionaire. So, you know, for someone based on their circumstances, you might be able to argue a big Bitcoin allocation. But for most mere mortals, someone who's working a day job and making a 5 or 6 figure salary and is simply trying to work to age 65, I think you'd be hard pressed to argue from a regulatory perspective, a 100% Bitcoin portfolio. I also don't know that you need to in order for that client to achieve their goals. You made the joke, Michael, that you have never sold any of your Bitcoin. You're really uncomfortable with that idea. Well, the day's going to come when you're going to want to buy a house, pay for a kid's college, or your mother's medical emergency, and you're going to need to sell your Bitcoin in order to come up with the cash for that bill, unless you go borrow the money, which you may well do. So, life gets in the way is all it comes down to. You know, people say in the long run, everything makes money. Well, in the long run, we're all dead. So we might as well take advantage of the money while we're alive. What I will say is this. There's another reason why the complacency exists. And this isn't at the advisor level. This is really important. This is at the firm's compliance officer level. The CIO and the CCO, the chief compliance officer and the chief investment officer. Both of these professionals have been doing what they're doing for decades. They're highly trained, highly skilled, and lots of experience. And they're the two gatekeepers. The investment officer determines what investments the advisors can offer. And the compliance officer determines whether they can do it, and if so, what guardrails exist. How much can they do? Which clients can they do it for? What disclosures do they have to give? And so on. These two gatekeepers usually say no. Why? It's not because they're complacent. And it's not because they don't like Bitcoin. It's because they're afraid of losing their jobs. If they say yes, and Bitcoin blows up, they might get fired. And they're predominantly worried about job security. Can't say I totally blame them. I get it in a big corporation. The small little advisor you described, who's running his own shop, who is the CIO and COO of his own little firm, he can do whatever the hell he wants. But if you're going to go to a big firm that has billions of dollars in assets, hundreds of employees, and tens of thousands of clients, they are concerned about their reputational risk and their job security. And that is what is preventing a lot of them from saying yes to Bitcoin, as sad as that is.
Yeah, no, it does make a lot of sense. I understand that they have families and people that they need to protect as well. It's just sort of an unfortunate reality, the oversight that they face. And by the way, my stance on selling my Bitcoin is my hope is that the day that I need the thing, I'm able to spend my Bitcoin. I would much prefer if we, in 20 years from now, I want to, you have a big medical bill or I have, you know, something I want to buy. I have the ability to just say, here, I'll send you some sats, counterparty risk free, no intermediaries. I think that would be a beautiful thing. So that's the future I'm trying to build with our company here at the Bitcoin Way. And we'll see if we get there. So Rick, we're running out of time. I told you I've got a bonus question I ask everyone, and I can't imagine you'll struggle with this. But what is an unpopular opinion you have? Bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
Yeah, I gave a speech at Bitcoin 24. People didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it because Donald Trump was doing his thing there. And I did offend the audience when I said this. And of course, you know, that room is filled with Bitcoiners. You know, I love you folks to death. You have pioneered and paved the way for everybody else. God bless you. But at this stage, some of you are now in the way. You are preventing the actual very growth, development, and adoption that you claim to seek. And you're doing it inadvertently. You know, your heart's in the right place, you're well-intentioned, but you're making a simple fundamental mistake. You are sometimes using the wrong words. You're using bad terminology. It's one of my big pet peeves about crypto. is that the words that Satoshi came up with and those who have followed him or her, whoever Satoshi is, are just using bad language. I'll give you just two examples. Bitcoin is trustless. I can't tell you, Michael, how many times I have people tell me one of the best benefits of Bitcoin and the Bitcoin blockchain is that it's trustless because you don't have to trust anybody. It's all guaranteed and fully disclosed and transparent on the blockchain. Do you realize that I spend my whole career as a financial advisor persuading my client to trust me and the advice I give them? And everybody knows this. I'm not going to do business with somebody I don't trust. We don't think of the word trust the way that blockchain developers think of it. To us, trust is paramount. We rely on trust of our clergy, trust of our parents, trust of our teachers. We've lost trust in our politicians. To say that Bitcoin is trustless is not endearing you to the hearts and souls of American consumers. It's a turnoff, not a turn on. Related to that is zero-point knowledge. Really? You're doing something with no knowledge? Now, I know what you're trying to say. The bartender doesn't need to know your date of birth, address, height, weight, and hair color to know you're allowed to legally drink in a bar. The bartender just knows you're legally allowed. So the bartender needs zero proof knowledge. But the phrase suggests I have no knowledge. And that isn't something anybody wants to brag about either. So there are a lot of terms and expressions and phrases that the Bitcoin community has created and the crypto community have created that are frankly doing more harm than good. Even the word token. In the world of stocks, we call them shares. Why did we have to invent this new word of token that nobody understands, let alone a non-fungible token? Nobody knows what fungible means, let alone non-fungible. So it's such a distraction. It's such an imposition that, frankly, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. So please speak English. Talk to a five-year-old. Don't pretend that I'm cool because I know this stuff. You're not showing off. You're just turning off.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point because when I think of trustless, I think of you don't have to rely on an intermediary, for example.
I know that's what you think it means.
I know you know that. But it's easy to there's a word and you sort of say it habitually. We need to be tactful when it's one thing when we're talking to Bitcoiners who we're all on the same page and we appreciate self-sovereignty and the trustless nature of Bitcoin. It's a very different thing when we're talking to folks who rely on trust in their communities and their relationships, their church, family, whatever, that it's not the way that maybe we sound like we're framing it.
This isn't a problem unique to crypto. You know, doctors can't talk to their patients in plain English. The car mechanic can't tell you what's wrong with the car that you understand what he's saying. We talk in jargon all the time, and we forget that ordinary people don't know what we're talking about. When I tell somebody that the expense ratio is 50 basis points, what the heck's a basis point? As opposed to saying it's 0.5%, you know? Yeah. So we make that mistake all the time. We think we're showing off and showing our knowledge, but in fact, we're just turning people away. So please talk in plain English. You'll do yourself and crypto a whole lot of good.
I think that's prudent life advice, not just when it comes to Bitcoin. So well said. Rick, hey, I can't thank you enough for coming on. This has been an absolute pleasure. Appreciate what you're doing and appreciate you spending time. Do you want to tell people where they can find you? I want you to tell people about the Digital Assets Council for financial professionals and anything else.
Yeah, DACFP is the preeminent organization that connects the crypto community to the TradFi community. We teach those of you in Bitcoin and crypto how to reach financial advisors who are the gatekeepers to America's wealth, controlling 2/3 of all the money in America. And we teach the TradFi community about crypto so that they will engage and allocate to Bitcoin and other digital assets. We offer the CBDA designation where advisors can prove to their clients that they've learned about this. We offer live events. We do probably 30 or 40 webinars a year. And I've written the Amazon number one bestseller, The Truth About Crypto, which is a very deep dive, not just into what it all is, but equally understanding how it works for ordinary investors and for financial advisors. Truth About Crypto is available everywhere. My white papers, both my six myths preventing you from buying Bitcoin white paper, and my white paper on the death of the 60-40 and why you need to allocate 10 to 40% to Bitcoin. Both of those white papers are available at dacfp.com, dacfp.com.
Beautiful. I'll link to it in the show notes as well. Rick, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to be with you, Michael. Thank you.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rick. It was an absolute pleasure having him on. Go check out the Digital Assets Council for Financial Professionals if you're interested. And again, very cool having someone like Rick with his wealth of traditional financial knowledge beginning to bring people into Bitcoin and educating them on this subject. Of course, if you need help with Bitcoin in proper 100% self-custody, taking custody of it the right way, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We also help with digital privacy, so things like privacy phones, personal cybersecurity for your laptop, your mobile device. We have a Plan B residency option in Panama. Lots of great self-sovereignty services geared toward the folks who might listen to a toxic Bitcoin maxi podcast like this. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it. It's @thebitcoinway_. Do me a favor. If you are enjoying the show, give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested. Anything to feed the algorithm, we would really, really appreciate that. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.